Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And we're going to start out tonight with just a little bit of advice. People born before 1954 can probably just go off to the bathroom, and you probably need to, so feel free. We're going to be talking about measles, and if you were born before 1954, you almost certainly had measles, because measles is one of the most infectious viruses in existence. We all learned about R1 during COVID. You know, oh, right now we're at R3, which technically means that each infected person is going to spread it to an average of three people. Well, measles comes in, and COVID, I believe, peaked at R5 in some areas. Measles averages R15. So for every infected person, 15 unimmune people will be infected, which basically means that when you start getting cases, you're likely to get a lot of new cases as a result. South Carolina has reported over 1,000 cases in its outbreak. Most of those in unvaccinated children. Last year in 2025, we had a record total of 2,267 cases. But why am I talking about measles? Well, I'm talking about measles because more and more people have had the measles vaccine. And if you've had a copy of the measles vaccine, one shot, which let's say you're 65 years old, you would have been right in that cohort who is A, only got one shot of measles, and B, starting to get to the age where that shot might be starting to decline. People who've had one shot are about 93% immune initially, but that declines after 40 or 50 years. And so get an immune titer. My advice to you is if you don't know your measles status, go get a blood test. It's called measles immune titer, and you can probably get your doctor to help you to code the order as, hey, we're having an outbreak, and that would be a good reason, and generally is a good reason to get things covered. Measles can also cause long-term problems, but it kills about one out of every 1,000 people. One out of every 1,000 get a brain inflammation called encephalitis. And one of the other things that can happen long after a case of measles is that it will give you something called immune amnesia. Your body will apparently the measles will attack the immune cells that remember things you've been immunized for. So you may lose your immunity to other pathogens that you've previously been vaccinated for. And we don't really know what's going to happen when you combine measles on top of COVID and whether you lose your immunity to that. There's no data. In rare cases, and I do mean rare, but the virus can actually get into your brain and do absolutely nothing for 15 years. Over that time, it picks up a few genetic mutations by living in the brain, and it then becomes capable of attacking neurons directly and turning them into scar tissue. This is called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, SSPE for short, and it's almost fatal. We did have one case of that in LA County last year, and indeed, the child died. So my point is, get your immune titer. You really want to make sure that you're immune to this right now. I want to jump on the soapbox a little bit and talk about, I've been meaning to talk about this for ages, and that's the way that Quest Labs gives you your alert signs, your high or your low, or you're in trouble red ink on the printout, and why they are doing this in such an incredibly unscientific and biased way. And when I say biased, it's basically an ad for statins. and the benefits of the levels that they're saying you need to achieve to be quote-unquote optimum are not science-based. And if you even look carefully at the fine print in their printout, all the data is coming from 2008 and 2012, and there's been substantial revisionism going on in cardiology as they've realized that, yes, there is such a thing as too low a cholesterol. I want to take a moment and step back and, you know, just ask a question that I get asked a lot, you know, Doc, what does it mean if there's an H here and it means it high? Is that normal? And the reason I'm on my soapbox about Quest is that they flag a normal cholesterol as dangerous. And it's just not true, but they flag it, and I don't know why they do it that way. It's not science-based, and they're creating a lot of upset in the population because they're like, oh my God, my cholesterol's too high, I'm going to have a heart attack. People think kind of directly and simplistically about this. So first of all, I'm going to step back. Let's go back to fifth grade math or whenever they teach this. Averages. So what is an average in math? It's you take all the measurements in a group. Let's say you measure the height in the classroom, and you'll get a range of, let's say, from 55 inches to 65 inches. So what you would do to get an average, also known as the mean, M-E-A-N, is you add up all the measurements in the group, and then you divide by the number of people in the group, and that's your average height. That's also your average test score, and most of you are probably familiar with, well, you know, for the A's, it's the top 15% on there, and then for the B's, and so on. So there's also something called a median, and the median is, let's say the lowest score is 10 and the highest score is 90, then the median score is going to be 45, right? It's just the middle of the range. But is the average normal? Is that what average means? Well, we also call the mean the norm. So yeah, the average is normal. So what Quest does is it calls the average, in other words, what the average person has, as moderate risk, which doesn't sound good. It sounds like higher risk than average, doesn't it? And you have to read the fine print on these things, and most people just look and see that they're red. So I have one here from a patient of mine. It's a very good cholesterol score, as far as I'm concerned. But she has, for example, her lipid particle number is 1385, which is in the moderate range, which is 1138 to 1409, but they've got it marked high. They've got an H next to it, big red H, but in their little fine print, high is above 1409, and she's 1385. So it's internally contradictory. Same thing with her small LDL. These are the small particles. Same thing with her medium particles. She's in the moderate range there, but they're putting an H next to it. If you go back down and read what they say, this is optimum relative risk. Optimum means it's a low risk. Moderate risk means it's an average risk. That's what moderate means, but it doesn't. If they said average there, people would not freak out. But that little red H freaks people out. And this is a person with a good lipid profile, a low cholesterol to HDL ratio, 2.4. This is not someone who needs to be put on a statin by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, that's kind of the default in this situation. So I'm done with riffing on Quest. Let's go to an email. Dear Dr. Don, my doctor looked at my EKG and told me she thought I might have had a heart attack in the past. When I look at the EKG, all I see is a bunch of jagged lines that look something like a seismograph. What do those sticky pads on my chest measure, and how can it tell you something about your heart, like a previous heart attack? I never had any chest pain or symptoms. Well, Anonymous, I'm going to start with the easy one there. That your doctor inferred that you may have had a heart attack is based on changes in the direction of those squiggly lines in a specific location. If you've ever been in a hospital room and watched the screen above a patient's bed show the EKG, you'll notice that the squiggly lines are not continuous. There's a kind of a grouping to them, then a pause, and then a repeat of the same grouping. And in that setting, you're looking at a single line of information, and the information is basically the direction of an electric signal that's being sensed by the pad at a moment by moment in time. So at any moment over time, the electric signal is either coming towards the pad, positive, or moving away from the pad, negative. So that's what the spike is doing. When it goes up, it's coming towards, and when it goes down or under the line, it's moving away. And during a single heartbeat, the electricity is moving back and forth across the heart like a ricocheting bullet. And from a single point of view on a single pad, you might see something like a sort of upward hill and then flat and then a small downward spike and a big upward spike and then a pause and then another flat upward hill and then another pause and then the whole thing would repeat itself over and over again. And we can read a great deal from these dancing spikes. Now, we're still in the hospital room looking at the TV thing. Now, that's a single lead. So what can we get from that? Well, we can get some information about the heart rhythm, where the pacemaker is, whether the pacemaker is beating regularly, or whether some other part of the heart is throwing out extra electrical activity that shouldn't be there, and which can mess up the heart rate. A common problem like atrial fib is identified by the space between the beats. Remember, I said there's a pattern and then a pause. Well, if the length of that pause is variable, it shouldn't be. If it's variable, then that means the person is in atrial fibrillation. The kind of heart rate variability that people talk about on the internet that indicates healthy heart or low sympathetic tone, relaxation, those are not really visible on an EKG without further computer processing. The dance of those ions across the heart creating that pattern is very carefully calibrated. And if the impulses travel too fast or too slow, they can collide. And that can lead to a big splash and a temporary or a permanent erratic heart rhythm that will quickly be fatal. Many drugs can alter the speeds of transmission and increase the risk of loss of this important coordination. So there are certain drugs, for example, that affect the QR interval, and any other drug that might increase the effect of that drug can't be mixed with it. These are the sorts of things when they say you don't mix drug A with drug B, and we have to be careful if someone's on one of these drugs that biases their heart towards a loss of rhythm coordination. We have to be very sure that they have the list of things they shouldn't take. And this is one of the ways that we kill people by accident in medicine, is that somebody doesn't check or the medication list isn't correct and it doesn't get flagged, or too many things are getting flagged in the system and people learn to ignore the flags, which is another problem entirely. But back to the heart. The heart's three-dimensional, hollow muscle. And so one pad can only see from one direction. With the 12-lead EKG, we have 10 lines that we can walk around and look at. So we can look at the electrical part. Excuse me, we have 12 lines. We can look at the electrical pattern from multiple different angles of perspective. Some pads are over the right side of the heart, some are over the left. If the spike is smaller than expected in a particular location or lead, that indicates that some of the heart muscle could be dead or damaged and thus does not produce as much electricity as it normally would. This is probably what your doctor saw on one of the leads, or maybe two of them, across your chest. If the spike is larger than expected, it might mean the heart muscle is overdeveloped in that area. Not always a good thing. A larger than normal spike could indicate a blockage in the downstream valve, like a tight aortic valve. It causes the heart to develop a larger muscle to push past the narrowing. It could also indicate high blood pressure or an extremely athletic fitness situation, because the heart has overdeveloped to push against the higher resistance of the blood pressure, or because of the high peak demand on the muscles from the athletic activity. There are also wide natural variations in the position of the heart in the chest. Some people's hearts hang like a clapper of a bell, almost vertically, and others recline on the diaphragm like a cat on a windowsill. I want to urge everyone out there, please, please, take basic CPR and learn how to use an AED, which stands for Automatic Electric Defibrillator. These devices are available in airports. They're available in concert venues, stadiums, many, many public places. And when used quickly by people who aren't afraid of them, because they're like, I don't want to shock myself. Yes, it won't shock you. It's a very safe thing to do. The instructions are very simple. It will talk you through the process. Watch the video. You'll be reassured and you'll be willing to grab that thing and open it and pop it on the person's chest. And if you do that, you more than double that person's chance of survival and recovery. So that is a gift that keeps on giving, I can assure you. So I hope that you will take my advice, and I hope that this helped you understand what an EKG is actually doing and why it's still, after 100 years of use, still one of the most widely available and valuable tools that we have for cardiovascular diagnosis. All right, so we had another email question, and this one is from Patty in Aptos, and Patty writes, Dr. Don, I am noticing a change in my taste sensation. I checked my sense of smell, and it seems just fine. I can distinguish odors easily, but food just doesn't taste as good as it used to. And what I notice is that when I eat something, the first bite will be very noticeable, but then by the time I get to the second or the third bite, it's like the food is pretty tasteless and tasteless for the rest of the meal. So let's talk about some of the possibilities for that. And there's the technical term for this is dysgeusia, taste alteration. And this can be caused by a number of different things, toxic effects, vitamins, some neurological things. We're going to go through those, but I want to highlight medications as being a really strong thing that I, as a doctor, don't think about nearly enough. And after getting this question and doing the research for it, I'm going to pin this little list up on my clipboard of things to, you know, look back up again. And eventually they get into my brain and then I don't need the clipboard anymore. But for a while, repetition is the mother of knowledge, as one of my professors said. So let me just read a lot of the cardiac drugs, calcium channel blockers, drugs like losartan, which is an ARB, beta blockers like metoprolol, Lopressor, Toprol, a lot of the antiarrhythmic drugs, amiodarone, profafenone, procainamide, sotalol, these are all things that are widely used for the aforementioned atrial fibrillation. Nitroglycerin can do it. A lot of the diuretics, almost all of the diuretics or water pills that we use can cause changes in taste or lessening of taste. All of the statins can do it. Plavix, an antiplatelet drug, a lot of antibiotics, a lot of analgesics, things like tramadol and even acetaminophen. So obviously, if you start a new drug, I think add to the list of things to watch for is a change in taste, because that could... And so the question for the writer, for the listener who sent in the question is, have you started any new drugs recently? Because that could account for this. Other things that are fairly significant are zinc deficiency or zinc toxicity. And actually, zinc itself is a really interesting mineral because not enough of it and you won't be able to smell or taste well. Too much of it and you won't be able to smell or taste well. And about 10 years ago, a zinc nasal spray for colds came out, and it was effective in reducing cold symptoms, and it was supposed to be acting as like an immune stimulator was the kind of the mythology around how this worked. But then it got pulled from the market after, I don't know, 6 to 12 months, because a lot of the people who used it lost their sense of smell. So zinc is tricky. You probably don't want to take more than 30 milligrams of zinc supplement a day. And zinc's present in certain nuts and other foods at fairly high levels. So if you're taking 30 milligrams a day of zinc, you probably want to look at foods high in zinc and make sure you don't binge on those, because you could get over that toxicity level, which is probably about 40 milligrams a day, after which, if you lose your sense of taste, you might want to stop taking your zinc for a month or get a zinc level. But if you've been on supplements, you probably aren't deficient. There are also a couple of odd neurological symptoms. Something called first bite syndrome is a sharp, severe pain. And it's a neurological disruption of the parotid gland. So before you start to salivate, it causes a twinge, and that for some reason turns down the taste. I think it's probably just one of those neurological things where it mutes the input because the output's been too great. Anyway, an interesting question in terms of what to do. Take a look at your zinc contact. There are things like Sjogren's disease and dry mouth, chronic low saliva content, definitely going to affect your sense of taste. But in this case, I'm betting on either drugs or zinc for this person's issue and urging her to check into those two things. So let's see, I've got another email on seed oils. I'm going to come back to that one and do a quicker one on this Prenuvo question. And the email was basically, hey, Doc, what do you think of the Prenuvo MRI? And there's a couple of companies, Prenuvo among them, which are now offering full-body MRI scans. And some of them are moving towards a subscription base or a bundled model. And prices are running, depending on what else is bundled in, with from $499 to $1,000, and that would be for the MRI. This technology is being coupled with pattern recognition of artificial intelligence, and it has the potential, and this is the pitch, it has the potential to save your life by finding a cancer early or a silent aneurysm or something that's there in your body that might cause trouble in the future but that isn't symptomatic at the time. The problem with that is that for every cancer that our current state-of-the-art MRI technology can find, they're going to produce a higher number of false positives where there is no cancer. Sometimes, depending on if it's a rare cancer, the chances of it being a false positive are 10 times greater, at least, than it being a true positive. And then you have to go through the biopsy or whatever, you know, the CT scan and the expense and the stress and potentially infection and bleeding, because if you go in for the tissue, you know, you're making a hole, you're introducing a portal for bacteria, and you're giving the person some heavy-duty drugs so that they can get through the process without pain. So not without, the biopsy itself is not without potential to cause harm. And if you're doing it because of a false alarm, and the and you go and get a false alarm once a year, and the false alarm's in a different place, and it's like, oh, well, we'll just have to check over there for that, you know, shadowy-looking thing on your kidney that could be a tumor, but then again, maybe it isn't. About 1 in 20 pre-NUVU scans require follow-up biopsy. About more than half of those are false positive. However, this was a study of 1,000 people that Prenovo presented. They found 22 cancers in that 1,000 people, and 86% of the people had no symptoms. It's a good question. Should I do it? My answer is probably not, because your odds of benefit are low enough, and your odds of getting your odds of benefit are lowish, you know, 1 out of 500 on the Prenovo study. The odds of benefit are low. The odds of a discomforting suggestion that you might have cancer and the need for further and more invasive studies to prove that you don't. And of course, just like with the genetic testing or the omic testing for cancer, you can't prove a negative anyway. All you can do is say, well, we can't find anything, but we better check again next year. And if you happen to be a company that gets $1,000 for every time we check again, just to be sure, that sounds like a pretty good deal. For the patient, I'm not so sure. And again, we need to emphasize, these are not going to be covered by your Medicare. They're not going to be covered by your insurance. So, you know, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying think twice before you do it. And we have another email, this one from Jessica in Santa Cruz. And Jessica writes, ask Dr. Don seed oils health effects. Dear Dr. Don, our mama's group has recently been having a discussion regarding the merits and drawbacks of seed oils. The following article from Johns Hopkins was specifically highlighted during our conversation. And I read the article. I'll be quoting from it and commenting on it in just a moment, folks. I recall you previously expressing caution regarding seed oils, which seemed to counter some of the points made in this article. I specifically remember you mentioned ghee and its benefits as a good medium for the microbiome. Would you be able to revisit this topic and share your current opinion? I suspect that this conversation about seed oils has fallen prey to the dualistic thinking that is all too prevalent these days. Something is either all good or all bad with little in between. Well, first of all, Jessica, I want to just agree with you about the good, bad, you know, red, blue, you know, no color in between sort of attitude. And also just the, how should I put it, appalling lack of detailed and nuanced discussion that happens on the internet. So this article itself that you mentioned from the Johns Hopkins is kind of a polemic against internet health influencers. Hi, I'm Peggy Perfect, the health mom, who say simplified, opinionated, simple secrets, lots of code words, lots of in-group kind of dialogue, and say things to build audience and to get rebroadcast. Oh, wow, I didn't know that about seed oils. I didn't know that about linoleic acid. I'm going to share it. And of course, anything gets shared gets paid. Within the article in the Johns Hopkins, they quote a couple of studies by a guy by Markand, and I'll just say that those studies were poorly designed, and I'll have some more specific criticism later on them. But let's talk about seed oils in general. And the first thing to understand is the difference between a fruit oil and a seed oil. So olive oil is a fruit oil. It's a soft flesh. It's an oil that's in the soft flesh of the plant, not the seed. Avocado oil is a fruit oil. It's in the soft flesh of the plant. not the seed. Coconut oil, while not a strictly speaking a seed oil, is in the soft part of a plant, of a seed, and it's debatable whether what they extract the oil from is. I don't know much about the process of extracting coconut oil, but I know it doesn't involve the use of an expeller. So all of the seed oils, safflower oil, rapeseed oil, which is called, I'm forgetting it, but there's another name for that. And all of these seed oils that you see being talked about have to be extracted from the seed. The seed is hard. You can't just squeeze the fruit and get the oil. You actually have to use an industrial process, something called an expeller press. And what's important about an expeller press is that this is a post-industrial revolution food. Couldn't get seed oils prior to something beyond just water power and wind power. You needed machine power, electrical or gas or whatever, but we're talking industrial revolution. And most seed oils, the ones that you will, invariably the ones that you will find in any kind of what we now call ultra-processed food, but which we used to call junk food, but any kind of junk food or cheap consumer food is likely containing expeller-pressed and then secondarily extracted seed oils, because they want us to get every drop of that oil out of there. Economies of scale, right? And they also will run the pulp that they've already squeezed through again and use a solvent to extract the oil. And the solvent they use is hexane, which is then, quote-unquote, evaporated off. And, oh, well, since it's evaporated off, we don't have to worry about it, right? Well, I worry about it. The stuff is a neurotoxin. So, hey, mama's group, children's nerves are much more, particularly infants, are much more vulnerable. And workers who breathe this, who are in the expeller press places, can actually go out on have to go out on disability because they're breathing so much of the solvent, which is evaporating off, that they get neuropathy. And if they stop their exposure, their neuropathy will reverse. But, you know, like I said, that's an adult, and they're much more resistant to nerve damage than an infant is. There's statements in the article, oh, it's not present in the product. But if you actually dig down and look at what the FDA says about it or the CDC says about it, they're like, well, we don't actually test for it at all, ever. And so how do you know it's not in there if you don't look for it? Well, you know is that you don't have any. It's not been found, but if it's not been found because you haven't looked, that isn't the same as you looked and you didn't find it. Much of the article from Johns Hopkins Public Health that you sent focused on the difference between omega-6 and omega-3 and said, well, you know, the omega-6s are, you know, here's this researcher, Markland, who did studies that showed that it's, you know, here's an example of his research. They measured the levels of linoleic acid in blood and adipose tissues of 68,000 participants across 30 countries, 30 studies in 13 countries. So what they did was they data mined the literature, and each of those studies followed their participants, some for as short as 2.5 years, other for more than 30 years. And when you added up all of the data, those with the higher levels of linoleic acid in their blood had lower risk of developing cardiovascular diseases. Well, people who eat more vegetables are going to have higher levels of linoleic acid. It may or may not be the linoleic acid that's giving them the benefit. And it could be a marker for some other dietary factor. You can't draw the kind of conclusions that this secondary paper is drawing based on the studies, which I actually went and looked up. And like I said, they're not good quality studies, and they aren't designed to ask the question. They were the other study he did looked at butter versus linoleic acid. I did find, and that was like, well, yes, vegetable oil is better than butter in terms of what you're going to get on your lipids. But I did not find it convincing on the subject of, well, omega-3s and omega-6s are the same. I still think omega-3s and getting that omega-3 level higher is a very good idea, and I have lots and lots of clinical experience, not scientific, no placebo control, that convinces me that it is true. I did, however, find a very interesting, very well done article in the British Medical Journal, and I will go ahead and post the link to this in the resources section on Ask Dr. Don. And this was a short trial, only 4 weeks, but basically what they did was they had three groups of healthy men and women in the general population. They got 4 weeks of one of three different dietary fats. They used extra virgin coconut oil, butter, and extra virgin olive oil, and they just looked at what happened to the lipids. So, and what they found was that that there was an increase in LDL concentrations in everybody taking 50 grams of oil on top of what they were already eating, but that the rise for olive oil and for coconut oil was the same, and the rise for butter was much higher. There wasn't really any difference between coconut oil and olive oil as far as LDL was concerned, and coconut oil significantly increased HDL, which olive oil didn't do. HDL is the good cholesterol, and particularly important, in my view, for men who tend to have a low HDL. I might be suggesting to my men who have low HDL and a bad ratio, so their total cholesterol divided by their HDL is greater than 5, regardless of the absolute numbers, I would be thinking about having them add some coconut oil. 50 grams a day is, you know, a reasonable amount of coconut oil, probably in the level of 2 teaspoons. It's not a huge amount. And then checking their levels in three, four weeks and seeing if I've improved that HDL, because this was new information for me. I also found it very reassuring. And for those of you that actually cook and are worried about the smoke point argument that was made in that Johns Hopkins article, was, well, if we double process it and we do the extraction with the hexane, it has a higher smoke point and it lasts longer, it doesn't go rancid as quickly. And, well, that's great if you're making a Frankenfood. Those are absolutely fabulous factors for long shelf life. If you're actually cooking with it on your own and you care about your smoke point, all you have to do, clearly, is throw some coconut oil in with your olive oil or your avocado oil or your cold expressed seed oil, which those are fine. I'm fine with cold expressed seed oils. I just don't like the hexane. The chemical extraction step strikes me as just not established as safe. And I want to make one more point about something like lard or butter. These being animal products, they're kind of like mercury in tuna fish, right? It's an apex herbivore, and it's eating an awful lot of stuff that is contaminated potentially. So I really think that the lard that was coming out of the cows that were eating on the prairie in Nebraska in 1930 is really different than the lard that's coming out of cows that are on feedlots off of Highway 5 in California in 2026. I think its chemical composition is so different, in fact, that they qualify as different foods. So we talk about paleo diet for ourselves, but we also want the animals that we eat to have been on as close to a heritage paleo diet as possible. And if anybody knows anybody who has heritage chickens and will sell me fryers who's local to the Monterey Bay, please send me an email because I want to talk to you. I have a high sensitivity to chicken, but it's industrial chicken. I just got back from 3 months in Indonesia, where the chickens don't look like our chickens very much, and they go around and eat grass and bugs and don't get, you know, Purina chicken chow. And that meat doesn't bother me at all. I have zero reaction. So you are, and you react to what you eat ate. And so same thing for the plants, right? You're eating the pesticides. You're eating the genetic modification, which itself maybe isn't harmful, but the residues that the genetic modification allow the food to be put on the food may themselves be kind of harmful. And yeah, don't get me started on corn.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.